Today's shiur is Masechet Bava Basra, Daf Mem Tes, and we will begin on Daf Mem Ches, Amud Beis, 10 lines from the bottom. It says the Gemara, Tevi Tal Lepapi Akinra V'Zofin. Rashbam says two pshatim in these words. One pshat is that Tabi wanted Papi to sell him something, so he hung him up on a tree to force him to sell the item that he wanted him to sell him. Another pshat is that Papi owned a kinor. Papi owned a kinra, a harp. And Tabi forced Papi to sell him his harp. Chosum Rabbi Babachana Maidor. Rabbi Babachana signed on a note indicating that this sale was done under duress. And he also signed on Ashkalta. He also signed on the document, on the sale document. Omar Afuna, and Afuna said, Man de Chosim, the fact that he signed on the Shtar Maidor, indicating that it was done under duress, Shapa Chosim, was done properly. Man de Chosim, and the one that signed Ashkalta on the Shtar Mechira, also Shapa Chosim, signed properly. It's fine to sign on both of these documents. And as Tosfos points out, our Gemara does not follow the opinion of Rava, whose opinion we learned on Daf Mem, that says that even though there's a concept of Shtar Maidor, there is no Shtar Maidor by sales. And here we're talking about a sale. Other Rishonim say that our Gemara could even follow the opinion of Rava. Because when did Rava say that there is no concept of a shtar maidor by sale? Rava was referring to a situation where Edim, in their opinion, saw a sale being done under duress. And they wrote a shtar maidor. Such a shtar maidor, says Rava, is unacceptable. But a shtar maidor in a situation where the person involved in the sale specifically instructed the Edim to write a shtar maidor, the Nebuka Yosef, the Ramban, suggest that even Rava would agree that it's an acceptable shtar maidor. Says the Gemara, Rav Huna says himself, Manavshach, how do Edim sign both these documents? In maidor, if there was a situation of maidor, lo yishkalta, they shouldn't have signed the sale document. Vishkalten, if they're feeling that the sale document is legitimate, and that's why they're signing it, my Maidah. So why are they signing Shtar Maidah? Says the Gemara Hachikama. What Rav Huna meant to say was, Ilav Maidah, if not that there was a Maidah here, man the Chosim Ashkalta, somebody who signs a Shtar indicating that something was done by force, by oinis, Shapar Chosim, it's still a valid transaction. Because Rav Huna is following the opinion that we learned so many times, is his opinion, Dam Rav Huna, Tului V'Zovin Zvina Zovin, that even if a sale is done under duress, the sale is considered a valid sale. Only when there's a Maidor is there a problem. Any, asked the Gemara, according to this, we understand Rav Huna saying that the signing of the Maidor invalidates the Shtar Mechira. Ask the Gemara of Omer Rav Nachman, Ha'edim Sh'omra Mono Ha'idvarenu, if Edim say that the document they signed was a Shtar Amona, which we learned in Masechet Ksubis is a Shtar written that a person didn't actually borrow money from someone else, but he writes a shtar that he borrowed money from this other person. And as the Gemara explained in Masechet Ksubis, there are two reasons why somebody would write a shtar amona. One is because he wants to have the shtar available, that if and when he wants to borrow money, he should have the shtar prepared. In those days, not everybody was qualified to write a shtar, so when the opportunity came up that they could write a shtar, they took advantage. That's one pshat. Another pshat, as we saw, is that a person wants to be considered wealthy, and one of the ways he'll be considered wealthy is if he has a number of receivables. And that's why they write a shtar amana, indicating that he's a wealthy person. Look, I have all these receivables. Furthermore, as we learned in Masechta Ksubis, there are a number of situations that we need to understand when we speak about a shtar amana. Certainly, in a situation where the shtar was written and with today's date, and then the loan will take place later, and that's going to be the date that they want to use for the shtar, such a shtar would be invalid. Because that would be, as we learned in Masechta Rosh Hashanah, a shtar chayiv mugdam. And we learned in the Gemara Masechta Rosh Hashanah that a shtar mugdam is possible. Rather, the situation that's being discussed here, explain the furthermore, just to say what would be certainly fine, if the person obligated himself starting from today that he's going to owe the money, even if no loan actually took place, everybody has a right to take on themselves such an obligation. The case here is that the shtar was written when no loan was actually done yet. Nobody accepted anything upon themselves yet, but they wrote a shtar that if he'll need to borrow money, this shtar should be the shtar for which that loan will be valid for, and it should be valid from today, even though the loan didn't take place. And the Gemara in Masechta Ksubis taught us that one is not supposed to write a shtar amona, as the pasuk says, "Al tashkein ba'alecha avlo." Having shtar amona in one's home is considered improper because one may come to use it even if the money is not really owned. So that's why Nachman said, "Ha'edim sha'amru." If Edom came and said that amonu hayudvareinu, that the shtar that we signed was a shtar amona, ain't amona. They're not believed because, as we just said, it's a shtar that you're not supposed to have. Furthermore, maidah hayudvareinu, and as the Rishonim explained, there are two reasons why one is not believed to say that the shtar we signed was a shtar amona. One is, as we just said, since halachically one is not supposed to have a shtar amana, so by saying that you were the aid to shtar amana, you're saying that you did an avera. Ein odom meisim atzmai rosha, and that's why the shtar amana is not, you can't say it. Another reason is because there's a rule that we also learned in Masechta Ksubis of kivin shehigid shuvein achayz romagid, that once somebody says testimony, he has no right to say testimony again. And once we have here a shtar indicating testimony that they said that they wrote this, that they are edim that this transaction, this halvah took place, that's considered a full-fledged shtar, and they have no right to retract, and we don't listen to another testimony that they would say. And again, as the Rishonim framed the Gemara, certainly, if we would be able to be Mekayim to verify the signatures on this shtar, because we have their signatures on file, or because there are people who recognize the signatures of these Edim, certainly they can't be believed to say Amona Hoidvarenu. On the other hand, says the Rivosh, if it were a situation where two Edom, not the same two Edom who signed the shtar, but two different Edom came and independently testified that the shtar that these Edom signed was a shtar amona, we would have a situation of trei v'trei, and we leave everything status quo. Our Mishnah, our Gemara Rav Nachman, is teaching us that it is the Edom who are signed on the shtar who are the only ones that are able to identify that this is their signature, and therefore we should theoretically have here a situation of Pesha Osa Pesha Hiter. It's they who are saying that this is their signature, but at the same time saying that it was a Shtar Amana, Still, ein namonim, for the reasons we gave, of ein odameis matzmarasha, or because kivin shegit shuv ein achazra magid. Similarly, if they said, my dar hayud vareinu, they're ein namonim, because here too, even though it may not necessarily be a situation of ein odameis matzmarasha, but it falls onto the category of kivin shegit shuv ein achazra magid. So the question now is, how could Rav Huna have said that the shtar maidah cancels the shtar mechira? Rav Nachman teaches us that that isn't acceptable. And as the Rishonim point out, even though Rav Nachman and Rav Huna are both Amoraim, and they may disagree with each other, still, since the halacha follows both the opinion of Rav Nachman and Rav Huna, the Gemara seeks a way of reconciling their opinions. Answers the Gemara, Hani Mili, when is there halacha that Rav Nachman taught us that if the Edim sign the shtar, and then there's another shtar, or they want to testify, then they say, Maido Amana, the Nat Neman, Hani Mili Alper, if they now want to offer testimony, oral, verbal testimony, it won't be accepted. Taleosa Alper, or Maril Ishtara. Their verbal testimony cannot nullify what it says in the Shtar. Ava B'Shtara, if there's a Shtar, there's a Shtar Maidah saying that this was done that way, that this was done under duress, there are Shtara Maril Ishtara. And there's a Machlokes Rishonim, how to understand the Gemara's Teretz. Some say that the Gemara's Teretz is very simple. Verbal oral testimony cannot nullify a shtar, because as we said earlier, since there's halacha edim hachsuma al shtar nasu kamisha nechgrei dusa bebezdin, that gives that signed shtar a lot of authority, a lot of validity, and no verbal testimony could undo it. However, another shtar, so we have one shtar against another shtar, that leaves us with a status quo situation, and the shtar would not be considered usable. However, others explain, other Rishonim explain, that the issue is not the shtar or the verbal versus the shtar. The issue is what comes first. If the shtar mechira, shtar hava, were written first, and now we want to say there was a maidah, we want to say that comes after the first star being written, and that's why the first star prevails. What's the nafkamina between these two pshatim of the Rishonim? So the Mefarshim explain following nafkamina. Let's say we'll have exactly this case, where Edom assigned on a star, and now they want to say that that was a star maidah. According to the first pshat of the Rishonim we quoted, only if the shtar maidah that they will bring was written, it makes no difference if the shtar maidah was written first or second, the halacha will be that it will nullify it. And therefore, what they can do, according to this pshat, is go, instead of offering verbal testimony, go commit their testimony to writing, even though their testimony will have a later date that it was a shtar maidah than the shtar mechira, it will still, since now we have two shtaris, have the ability to void the first shtar. But according to the other pshat that we said, even if they'll go and write now a shtar maidah, since this shtar maidah will come after the shtar mechira, then it won't be useful. Because according to that pshat of the Rishonim, the only time the shtar maidah has the ability to void the shtar mechira is if it precedes the shtar mechira. But if they're only going to write this now and want to rely on it to void the shtar mechira, it's too late because it will have been written after the shtar mechira. Says the Gemara, Gufa, Amar Rav Nachman, as Rav Nachman said, Amona hayud vareinu, if Edom come and say that what they wrote was a shtar maidah, Amana in Amanam under any circumstances. Maidayad Vareinu, similarly said Rav Nachman, as we explained a moment ago, if they say Maidayad Vareinu in Amanam. Amabar of Ashyama, Amana hayudvareinu. If they say what they wrote was a shtar amana, indeed ein amanim, because writing a shtar amana is an avera. Atashkim ba'olecha avla ein adam esmatzma rosha, and that's why they're not believed. However, ma'idah hayudvareinu. If they say that what they wrote was a shtar ma'idah namanim, ma'itama shazen nitin likasef. A shtar maidah is a shtar that may be written, versus a shtar amana is a shtar that may not be written. Machlokes rishonim, when the Gemara uses the word zen nitin likasev, what does it mean? To what shtar is it referring? We explain that it's referring to the shtar maidah. There's nothing halachically wrong with writing a shtar maidah. But another pshat that I saw, is that not in the kosev? You have to write the shtar mechira, even though you wrote a shtar maidah, because that's the entire situation, that the person is under duress and under pressure, and he has no choice but to write the shtar. Machloikus rishonim, how far to take the opinion of Rav Ashi? In other words, Rav Ashi says that if the Edom say it was a shtar maidah, then Neman is, the Rashbam says, even if we can independently verify the signatures on the Shtar Mechira, that won't change what Rav Ashi says, that if the Edom say that it was Maidah Hadvareinu Namonim. Tosfos, however, says that the only time even Rav Ashi will say that the Edom have this Namonis is if we don't have the ability to independently be Mekayim the Shtar. And that's why part of the Namonis is based on a Pesha Osa, Pesha Hitter. But if we have the ability to independently verify the Shtar, even Rav Ashi will agree that we won't believe them when they say Meidah Hadvareinu. The Mishnah said, V'loil ish chazoka b'nechse yishtoi. A husband can't establish a chazoka in his wife's property. And as we have said, Baruch Hashem, so many times, there are two types of properties that a wife brings into her marriage. One is nechse tzoyim barazol. Nechse tzoyim barazol means that we assess the value of these properties that she brings into the marriage, and when the marriage terminates because the husband died or divorced her, he has to pay her that assessed value, but the properties are his. Certainly, when we speak about a husband being able to establish a chazaka on a wife's property, we don't speak about nechse tzoyim barazol, because they're his. Here we're speaking obviously about nechse melug. Nechse melug are properties that the wife brings into the marriage, and as long as they're married, the husband eats the payrus of these nechse melug, and then when the marriage terminates, these nechasim are returned to the wife. And our Mishnah says that the husband has no right, has no ability to establish a chazaka in these nechasim. Ask the Gemara, obviously he has no ability. Pshita, kiven the istay lepeira, since he's, as we just said, entitled to eat the peiris. So peira, the kachal, is eating his own peiris. So there's no reason for the wife. What's the whole vart of a chazaka that we've been learning? That the owner of the property should have protested. Here she has nothing to protest. He has every right to eat this peiris. So obviously, he doesn't have the ability to establish a chazaka. Answers the Gemara, like Tzricha, our Mishnah is referring to a situation, the Kasulah that the husband wrote, Din Udvarim Enli B'Nechosayich, that even though I'm entitled to eat the Paris, I'm forfeiting that right. So he doesn't have the right to eat the Paris. And the Mishnah is teaching us that even though he doesn't have the right to eat the Paris, because he forfeited that right, and now he ate the Paris for 3 years, still, the fact that the wife did not protest does not prove that he actually bought those properties for the wife, because the wife could say, as we explained when we learned the Mishnah, she didn't want to protest, it's her husband. Ask the Gemara, v'chichasvlo, even if he did write such a statement to her, my hava v'tanya haim l'chaveroi din udvarm ein liyasadazu, if somebody says I have no claim to this field, ein liyasikba, in all these situations, what he said is meaningless. As the Rashbam says, the halacha views it like a tefillah. Halavai, I didn't have any rights to this property. But it doesn't have any real halachic meaning. So what's the Gemara saying, that he has no rights to the Paris because he made the statement? Halachically, the statement has no value. Amrle de Beir Rabbi Yanai, Masknisen Bekosev Lo Voidarusa. Our Mishnah is referring to a situation that he wrote this while she was still in Arusa. In other words, once they're married, once there's Nesuin, and they're entitled, and he's entitled to eat the Paris, just by saying Din Udvarm only of Paris Zu, it's a meaningless statement. On the other hand, explain the Rishonim, if he said this even before they had a Arison, because we know every Jewish marriage is done in two steps. One is Arison, and the next step is Nesuin. And then once there's Arison, the wife is considered an Eishes Ish, but she isn't, the marriage isn't consummated, and he isn't entitled to the Paris yet. But since they already have a relationship, there's Arison. But prior to Arison, he has no right to make the statement because they have absolutely no relationship yet, and the statement is meaningless. Our Mishnah, therefore, says Reb Yanai, is referring to a situation where they already have a relationship. There is already Arison between this man and woman. And at that point, since he isn't yet entitled to eat the Paris, he has a right to make the statement. And as the Rishonim point out, it doesn't necessarily have to be in writing. It could have been in verbally also. Rav Kahana, we find this concept taught us by Rav Kahana. Dom Rav Kahana, Nachla Bala Adam Mimakim Acher. If a person is entitled to Yerusha Mid Rabbanon, that means a husband is entitled to Yarshin his wife, he has the ability that before the wife dies, Adam Masna Leh Shlo Yerushana, he has the right to make it tonight, that he's forfeiting that right. Here too, since they are Murasim already, but he hasn't yet received the right to get the Paris, at that point he has the right to forfeit that right. Machloikus Rishonim, when Rav Kahana, our Gemara, teaching us that he has the right to forfeit his rights to the Paris, doesn't mean only from the properties that his wife, who's now his Arusa, owns currently, but properties that will become hers, only after the Nesuin. He does not have the ability now to forfeit, because she doesn't even own them. They're in the category of Davish Shlomo Lailam. Or does he have the ability to forfeit the right? And that right, since they are already somewhat connected, because there's an Arison here, is all-encompassing, both properties that she already owns and properties that she will eventually own. The Rishonim also suggest that the Gemara could have given a teretz that our Mishnah is referring to properties that the wife owns, that the person who gave her those properties specified when he gave her a property that your husband should have no right to those, to the property, to the Paris, and the Mishnah is still teaching that the husband doesn't establish a chazakah on those properties. The Rishonim also discuss, why does our Mishnah why does the Gemara speak about a case where he said to her, Din Udvarim Eli bin Chasim Elu, provided that he said it as long as they're only Arison? Why doesn't the Gemara explain that there was a Kinyan? So some Rishonim explain that the Gemara could have given that teretz, but the Gemara is trying to teach the Chiddush, that even though, as we just learned a few moments ago, that this terminology of Din Udvarim Eli bin Chasim Elu is a very weak halachic terminology, and we would think therefore has never any validity, teaches us the Gemara a circumstance where it does have validity. But certainly if he wanted to make a kinyan to this effect, it would certainly be acceptable. However, other Rishonim suggest that a kinyan would not be effective. It's only this type of language that our Gemara is bringing, where he says, Dinu Dvarim Eli bin Chosim Eli, where he's mesalik, he's relinquishing, he's forfeiting his rights, that's halachically valid. But to make a kinyan, there would be a problem, because it would be considered a makna, a davar shelo bo la'olam. And a kinyan on a davar shelo bo la'olam is ineffective. So the Gemara said that one could forfeit his rights on a, and the Rishonim explained, on something that he's only entitled to midrabanan prior to his being able to get it. So therefore, as we explained, a Yerusha, that a husband is entitled to Yarsh and his wife, before his wife dies, the husband could forfeit that right. Well, what about a Yerusha d'oraisa? Before one's father or parent dies, that, the Rishonim say, a person cannot forfeit. Why? So the Rashbam explains, since this is something, the Yerusha midaraisa, something that is entitled to midaraisa, siluk, relinquishing, forfeiting, siluk, is not possible on something that is entitled to midaraisa. As the Rambam adds, the Torah, when it speaks about Yerusha, uses the words chukas mishpat, firmly established to be his, and therefore siluk will be ineffective. Another pshat that I saw that the Ran explains, so assets that one is entitled to Yarsha Midaraisa, the halacha views as if they are his, somewhat in his possession already. And as we're learning, siluk is only possible on something I don't yet have. But something that I'm entitled to Yarsha Midaraisa, the halacha views as if I already have it, and therefore siluk is impossible. Rashi and Masechta Ksubos makes a different distinction. Rashi says there that siluk is only possible on something that I created this right. That means when a husband marries a woman, so he, by doing that act of marriage, is entitled to his wife's peiros, the peiros of his wife's nuts malug. So there siluk is possible. But Yerusha is not something created by an act of my act. Yerusha is, the Torah says that I'm entitled to Yerusha. And therefore, somebody cannot make siluk on such a right. Other Rishonim, Achroinim, want to explain that the reason siluk isn't possible on something that is entitled Midaraisa, because that will fall into the general category, which we've discussed many times, of Masna Amasha Kosu B'Torah. Ukid Rava. And we find this concept that Rav Kahana is saying, Rava said the same, Dama Rava, Kala Oimari Efshe B'Tekanas Chachamim, if somebody says, I don't want to make use of a right that the Chachamim gave me, Kigoyin Zois, I'll explain what that means in the second Shemalai. Mike goes to us, what is the example? Rav Huna Marav, Yechoyel Ish Shetayim Labala, a woman could say to her husband, Ein in the Zoynus Vein Ois. As we learned in Masechta Ksubos, a Chazal instituted that a wife should be supported by her husband, and in return, a wife has to give all of her income that she earns to a husband. A wife has a right to say, before she earned the income and before the husband supported her, I don't want him to support me and I don't want him to get my income. As we learned in Masechta Ksubos. Certainly, there are certain activities that a wife is obligated to do for a husband under all circumstances, and she has no ability to make any tanoim to relinquish that obligation. Here we're referring not to those basic activities, and if the wife is, her income is greater than her support, or she doesn't want to take on the obligation to work, can make this tanai. Says the Rashbam, so just like she can make that tanai, similarly, there's another takonis chazal. The chazal said, peiros takas perkuna, that the peiros of the nichsim melug go to the husband, and in exchange, that were the wife chas v'shalom to be kidnapped, the husband has to ransom her, and the husband could agree, say, I'm giving up the right to those peiros, and I don't have to ransom her. That's how the Rashbam learns the Gemara. Tosfos disagrees with this last vart that we quoted from the Rashbam, because Tosfos says such a tanai, a husband can never make a tanai that I won't ransom my wife and I don't want the peiros. And neither can the wife. Why? Because there's two concerns, two reasons. One is quite simple. We don't want to have a situation where chas v'shalom, the wife is kidnapped and she is ransomed and she'll be left with the kidnappers. A totally unacceptable situation. Furthermore, when we speak about peiros, when we speak about mezoinus support and income, every day is a new obligation. So a wife could say today, I don't want to be supported and I won't give you my income. Tomorrow, she could change her mind and say, yes, I want to be supported and I'll hand over my income. However, by peiros and ransom, perkuna, we can't say that. They could be married, Baruch Hashem, for many, many years, and there'll never be a need to ransom her. Hopefully, there'll never be a need ever. So you can't make it on a day-to-day basis, and therefore, he can never avoid the obligation of ransoming her. But even according to Tosfos, even though a husband cannot avoid the obligation of ransoming her, he can relinquish the right to the peiros, and that's what our Mishnah is teaching us. And this disagreement between the Rashbam and Tosfos, that's what our Mishnah is teaching us, that if the husband relinquished this right, he still won't establish a chazakah. The Mefarshim, the Rishonim, and the Achronim ask that our Gemara is teaching us that there's a takonis chazal. It's the Takan of the Rabbanon, that the wife gets supported, but she has to hand over her income to her husband. Ask the Rishonim. The Gemara Masechta Ksubis debates, we spoke recently, that a husband is obligated to give his wife Sheira Ksusa Vainasa. And the Gemara debates, what is the definition of Sheira? One explanation is that he has to support her. Machlok is Tanor. Another explanation is that he has to have relations with her. So ask the Rishonim, the Achronim, according to the Tanon, and according to the Rishonim, that Paskin like those Tanon, that Sheira means support, so it's a Chiv D'Oraisa. So what does the Gemara here mean, that it's a Takonas Chazal, that he has to support her, and she has to give him her income? So the Rashba says a tremendous Chiddush. The Rashba says, yes, Sheira means midaraisa, that a husband has to support his wife. But the Rabbanan added a condition, and he says the Rabbanan have the authority to do so. And they added the condition that a wife can, that even though midaraisa, the husband has to support the wife, that obligation only exists if the wife will give the husband her income. And if the wife will not give the husband her income, then the Rabbanan nullified, voided the chiv, the rights of a husband to support a wife. Very bechiddush. Pnei Yeshua also says a very interesting teretz. He says, even according to the opinions that she'era means support, and with the rights a husband has the obligation to support a wife, that's only a wife who doesn't have an independent means of supporting herself. But if the wife has the ability to independently support herself, everyone will agree that there's no chiv d'oraisa to support the wife, and that's the case that our Gemara is referring to. Says the Gemara, our discussion in the Mishnah is regarding the husband establishing a chazaka in the wife's property, haraya, but proof that if he offered proof that he bought this property, yes, that would be acceptable, and that would be it would become his. Ask the Gemara, why should that be acceptable? Tema, why can't she say that she signed the document indicating that she sold it to him? Because Nachas Ruach, Sisila Bali, she wants to be nice to her husband, and therefore she signed the document, even though she really didn't mean it. So ask the Rishonim, but aren't we in the middle of the sugya of Rav Huna of Teluya Vizavin Zvini Zvini? Even though you did something even under duress, it's still considered a valid sale. So yes, she'll say I sold it to him because nachas ruach asis labali. But that doesn't change that it should still be considered a valid sale. So the Rashbam answers that the only time we say the svara of Tluya v'zoben zvini zvivin is when there's real pressure. But it doesn't apply to a situation like Al Gemara is discussing, where the wife reluctantly consents to sell her property just not to get her husband angry. The Ramban has a problem with the Rashbam's pshat, because the Ramban says if real pressure, according to Rav Huna, still makes the sale valid, so here if it's considered lesser pressure, it should certainly make the sale valid. So therefore the Ramban says that the only time we say Teluya v'zavim zvina zivin is when the seller receives money. But here the wife is not receiving any money. There even Rav Huna agrees it's not considered a valid sale. It's like we learned, we quoted this opinion many times, that even Rav Huna agrees that a gift given under duress is not considered a valid gift. Davni Meluim takes a different approach. He says that the Gemara is assuming that the reason the wife consented to the sale is because she wanted to keep the shalom bayis of the home. And therefore, her consent was only as long as the marriage, during the duration of the marriage, she's agreeing to the sale, because that will keep peace at home. But it's not that she's agreeing that this sale should be a permanent sale. And the Gemara proves that there is such a concept of a woman being able to say, Nachas ruach asis labali. Miloy tanan, we learned in a Mishnah, Lokach min ish, if somebody bought a property from a husband, v'chazva lokach min isha, and then he bought from the wife. Because as we've learned, when a man gets married, there's a lien on every property he owns to pay the ksuba. So if somebody wants to buy a piece of property from this husband, and he wants to buy it mortgage free, what he does is, he buys the wife's lien from her. The halach is mechle betel. It's not considered, the purchase of that lien is considered invalid. Alma, because she could say, even though I agreed to the sale, I only did it because nachas ruach asisi labali hachanami. So even in our Mishnah, even if the husband could offer documentation that the wife sold him the property, why should that documentation be considered valid? Why can't she argue, I only signed it because nachas ruach asisi labali? I saw a beautiful vart from the Beis HaLevi. He says, we all remember that the Torah, by Kabbalah, the Torah says, Moshe Rabbeinu says to Klal Yisrael, Kosoim al Beis Yaakov, v'sagid l'bnei Yisrael. And the famous Rashi teaches us, Beis Yaakov, Elu ha-Noshim, are the women, b'nei Yisrael, Elu ha-Noshim, are the men. And the question comes up, why did Moshe Rabbeinu speak to the women before the men? The answer, says the Beis HaLevi, is it had to be specifically in this order. Because if the men would have first accepted the Torah, and then they would have gone to the women to accept the Torah, they could always argue later that they accepted the Torah because Nachas Ruach Asis Labali. We didn't want to argue with our husbands. And once they accepted the Torah, we also accepted the Torah. To avoid that ultimate possible claim that the women would have, that's why the Torah first went Kosoim l'Beis Yaakov, first to the women, and afterwards V'sagid l'Bnei Yisrael. Similarly, the Mefarshim explain, the Pasuk says, when Klal Yisrael contributed to the Mishkan, V'yavayu ha'anoshim al ha'anoshim. And as the Mefarshim explained, that the women preceded in giving contributions before the men. Why? Again, for the same reason. Because if the men would have contributed first, and then they would have approached the women could always say that they gave only because Nachas Ruach Asisa Labali, our husbands gave, and then we didn't want to argue with our husbands, we didn't want to be different than our husbands, so therefore we also gave. And as we're learning, that's considered doing something under duress. They wanted to give Nidves HaMishkan, the contribution to the Mishkan, wholeheartedly. The only way it would be able to be done wholeheartedly is V'yivoy HaNoshim, Ala HaNoshim, the women should give first, where it isn't yet a concern of Nachas Ruach, Asisi Labali.